And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis, and with Free Radio Santa Cruz, I urge you to have a pencil and paper handy to write down any names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, something you might want to act on later. Let's get started. The Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week, marking the earliest family group migration into the Hebgen Basin that we have experienced. Around 40 buffalo dropped down from Yellowstone's high plateau and made their way west to Horse Butte in early October. It's not unusual to see a solitary bull or a small bachelor bull group come into the basin this early, but it is rare to see larger matriarch-led family groups make such an early appearance. For a time, they were out of harm's way, enjoying peaceful days on 800 acres of buffalo-friendly land shared by the Galanis family. We had hoped they would be content to remain there. The six-month-long hunting season has begun, and we knew that word would get out that the buffalo were outside Yellowstone's boundaries. And it did. Beginning in October and lasting through January, the Confederated Salish, Kootenai, and Pend'Oreille tribes are conducting their treaty hunts. The state of Montana's hunt begins November 15th and lasts through February 15th, and the Nez Perce, Umatilla, and Shoshone-Bannock tribes will begin treaty hunting this winter, not closing their seasons until the end of March, which is just a few short weeks away from calving season. During these excruciatingly long 6 months, buffalo are also threatened with capture, slaughter, and hazing. This season, the Interagency Bison Management Plan agencies intend to kill 900 of America's last wild, ecologically extinct buffalo through hunting and slaughter. About a week after these family groups arrived on Horse Butte, KSKT hunters arrived in the Hebgen Basin west of Yellowstone. It was extremely difficult for us to cover the area as we have so few people at camp right now, but the buffalo have extended family around the basin, and friends on Horse Butte helped us monitor the situation. Unfortunately, the buffalo did leave their safe zone. Two were killed by KSKT hunters. The good news is that the remaining buffalo in this group made their way east again towards Yellowstone, where they are now safe from hunters. It saddens us that such an awesome event as the return of buffalo was met with rifle fire. We should be singing buffalo welcoming songs, honoring their return, celebrating our friends returning to this favorite area of their habitat, their home. There is so much we could learn about the buffalo and so much we could learn about ourselves through them, but instead they are met with violence and forced to flee to protect their families. When these hunts first began, buffalo were virtual sitting ducks, having grown accustomed to millions of visitors to Yellowstone aiming cameras at them, shooting photos. When they emerged from the park and were met with hunters aiming rifles at them, confusion set in. But over the years, buffalo seem to have learned who their friends are, and they are growing ever more savvy, leaving areas where they are vulnerable and seeking safe places. This works a little better for buffalo in the Hebgen Basin than it does in the Gardner Basin. The deep snows that will blanket the Hebgen Basin make it a little more challenging for hunters to reach them in certain but definitely not all areas, and there are more privately owned buffalo safe zones here. Plus, some hunters don't want to deal with the cold that we get in West Yellowstone. In the Gardner Basin, the buffalo are much more vulnerable. The landscape is much more open, and buffalo are easily accessible from many of the roadways throughout the Gallatin National Forest. And when they do seek the safety of the park's boundaries, they are met by another face of death, Yellowstone's Stevens Creek Bison Trap. On the north boundary, buffalo are damned if they do and damned if they don't. For now, the buffalo that were vulnerable to hunters in the Hebgen Basin have made their way to safety. We hope it will last, but buffalo must roam. They must leave the political boundaries of the park to escape the deep winter snows to survive. Currently, there is no place they can go save the small areas of private land on Horse Butte without being threatened with gunfire. Our field season begins in just a few weeks. America's last wild buffalo will be under attack in the Hebgen and Gardner Basins north and west of Yellowstone. Will you join us on the front lines to stand with the buffalo? Buffalo Field Campaign needs volunteers for the coming season. If you are unable to join us in person, you can still help us on the front lines and you can help spread the word and to save the sacred herds. If you want to find out any or all of this information about the Buffalo Field Campaign, please go to their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. If you want to send them a donation, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Once again, that address, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call, area code 406-646-0070. Once again, 406-646-0070. All this information and more can be found at their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. An Oregon town seeks solutions to droves of fearless deer. In this story by Shelby Siebens, editing by Daniel Wallace and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A town in southern Oregon will hold a public meeting to discuss how to deal with droves of fearless deer that wander the streets, occasionally acting aggressively towards residents, state wildlife officials said recently. The Deer Summit 2015 will be chaired by Ashland Mayor John Stromberg as part of efforts to address deer that have stalked people, pawed at them with their hooves, and even stomped on small dogs. The deer have no fear of humans, said Mark Vargas, district wildlife biologist for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The confident deer are a product of a long tradition in the town of 21,000 people of feeding and befriending them, Vargas said. For the last two or three decades, the black-tailed deer have known to roam into yards and stroll the downtown area of Ashland, Oregon, which lies in the heavily forested foothills of the Siskiyou and Cascade Mountains. Deer just live there, Vargas said. They live amongst the people, and when that happens, there's going to be conflict. Stromberg said to the city's website that he wants to hear from community members with ideas about what to do. The mayor could not be reached for comment recently, but city officials have urged residents not to feed the deer and to put up deer fencing or deer-resistant plants. In a statement, the officials said in a recent attack on a homeowner by deer protecting its fawn was a reminder that locals share the community with all manner of wildlife. No matter how cute and seemingly domesticated, these are wild creatures. Their behaviors are unpredictable. Vargas said there is no easy solution. Giving the does birth control would be costly and ineffective, he said, and one would have to kill between 40 and 50 deer a year to have an impact that way. Trapping and moving them would just transfer the problem to another community, as the deer have become acclimated to city life, he said. Vargas encourages people to stop feeding the deer and to yell or make loud noises when they enter their yard. In reality, we encourage folks, look, don't feed the deer, he said. They don't need food. They don't need water. If you can, don't even be friends with them. And a prosecutor is reviewing the killing of an endangered wolf in Oregon. In this story by Shelby Siebens, editing by Sharon Bernstein and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Prosecutors in Oregon are weighing whether to criminally charge a hunter who killed an endangered gray wolf while attempting to kill coyotes, authorities said recently. The hunter, who officials have declined to name, reported to Oregon wildlife authorities on October 6th that he had shot the gray wolf while hunting coyotes in Prairie City, Oregon, a small town about 284 miles southeast of Portland. Prosecutors said they would decide as soon as next week whether to charge him with illegally killing a gray wolf, a crime that carries a maximum penalty of $6,250 and a year in jail, wildlife officials noted. Oregon State Police concluded their investigation recently, turning it over to prosecutors for review. Tim Colahan, district attorney of nearby Harney County, where the case was moved because of a potential conflict of interest, said he still needs to go through the evidence gathered by police. I am still collecting and have not received all the evidence and reports yet, he said. Colahan said he hopes to get all the evidence from state police by the end of this week and could make a decision as early as next week. Gray wolves, native to Oregon but wiped out in the state in an eradication program in the early 20th century, first returned to Oregon in 2008 and have now spread to several parts of the Pacific Northwest state. Oregon has about 80 wolves in 15 packs, State Wildlife Commission spokesperson Michelle Dennehy said. The killing comes as the state commission plans to consider delisting wolves from the State Endangered Species Act at a meeting in Salem on November 9th. The wolf was a male, originally from the Umatilla River Pack in northeast Oregon. He wore a radio collar from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, which tracked him under the name OR-22. The wolf's death is the third in recent months and comes after state police last week suspended its investigation of two wolves found dead in Wallawa County in late August. Wildlife activists on Tuesday called on officials to punish the hunter. All hunters have an ethical and moral responsibility to be absolutely certain of their targets before they pull the trigger, Portland-based wildlife advocacy group Oregon Wild said in a statement. Whether by mistake or not, this hunter broke the law. And a deer trafficker gets a record fine for a U.S. wildlife crime. In this story by Letitia Steen, editing by Peter Cooney, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A Georgia man was ordered to pay $1.6 million, the largest fine ever levied against someone for a U.S. wildlife crime, after pleading guilty to offenses involving the illegal transport of white-tailed deer, U.S. officials said recently. Benjamin Chasen was sentenced this summer, but his case was sealed until recently in federal court in southern Ohio. Chasen, 61, from Climax, Georgia, was prosecuted along with Donald Wainwright, Sr., 49, of Live Oak, Florida. The pair owned a hunting preserve in Ohio called Valley View Whitetails, where they charged hunters thousands of dollars to kill deer, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said in a statement. Wainwright, who operated illegal hunts at the preserve, pleaded guilty to wildlife crimes in February and was sentenced to 21 months in prison and a $125,000 fine, according to the statement. Working together, they illegally attempted to ship deer that had not been certified to be disease-free in the United States. One shipment was intercepted en route to Georgia when regulators observed antlers sticking out of a cargo trailer, according to U.S. wildlife officials. Chasen owned additional hunting land in southern Georgia, and Wainwright had another property in northern Florida. Both men pleaded guilty to multiple violations of the Lacey Act, which is the first federal law to protect wildlife when it was passed in 1900, according to the statement. In addition to his fine, Chasen was sentenced to 3 years probation and 4 months of house arrest. Wainwright's son, Donald Wainwright Jr., also pleaded guilty in connection with the illegal hunts and was sentenced to probation and house arrest, regulators said. And an Iowa taxidermist has been sentenced to 27 months for illegal rhino horn trade. In this story by David Bailey and John Herskowitz, editing by Mohammed Zargam and Eric Walsh, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. An Iowa taxidermist who pleaded guilty to buying and selling black rhino horns in violation of U.S. laws protecting endangered species has been sentenced to 27 months in prison, court records show. James Hess of Maquoketa, Iowa, will also have 3 years of supervised release after serving his prison term, according to documents filed in the U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, for the sentence handed down. Prosecutors said Hess was involved in the purchase and resale of at least two sets of black rhino horns in 2011. An agreement between Hess and prosecutors put the value of the horns at between $200,000 and $400,000. International crime syndicates often acquire rhino horns, which are used in traditional Asian medicine and sell at prices higher than gold in Vietnam, where a belief, having no scientific basis, exists that they can cure cancer. Poaching of rhinos has surged across Africa in recent years, especially in South Africa, which has more than 80% of the world's rhino population. U.S. District Chief Judge Linda Reed sentenced Hess at the lower end of the guideline range of 27 months to 33 months. Hess pleaded guilty in May to one count of violating the Lacey Act, which makes it a crime to buy or sell endangered species. He was prosecuted as part of a multi-state investigation into the illegal trafficking of rhinos and other endangered species, prosecutors added. They said Hess arranged to acquire horns from an Oregon man in August of 2011 and have them shipped to Iowa, where another man would transfer them to California. He also purchased black rhino horns in Illinois in April of 2011, prosecutors added. Hess was ordered to self-report to prison at a later date. Loggers in China destroying parts of panda sanctuary, according to Greenpeace, in this story by Megha Rajapalan, editing by Clarence Fernandez, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Loggers in China's southwest are destroying sanctuaries home to endangered giant pandas, environmental group Greenpeace said in a report, defying efforts by conservationists and tougher forestry regulations. Logging of more than 3,200 acres of natural forest has threatened the habitats of rare plants and animals in the Sichuan giant panda sanctuaries, Greenpeace found during a 2-year investigation. The sanctuaries are a UNESCO World Heritage Site. These loopholes are allowing an area of international recognized significance to be exploited for profit, endangering local wildlife and global treasures, such as the iconic and rare giant panda, Greenpeace said. Developers had turned some areas of natural forest into profitable plantations while exploiting a loophole that allows reconstruction of forests, it added. The investigation used tools such as remote sensing, spatial analysis, and field surveys. Forestry officials in China did not immediately respond to a request for comment. There are only about 1,600 giant pandas left in the wild, and the World Wildlife Fund has said, Chinese government figures, about 300 live in captivity. The critically endangered animals native to China have an extremely low reproductive rate, particularly in captivity. And Sao Tome convicts the captain and two crew of illegal fishing. This story by Wendell Rolfe, editing by James Macaria and Toby Chopra, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A Sao Tome and Principe court won a key victory against illegal fishing by organized syndicates on Monday when it convicted a captain of a vessel and two crew members on a number of charges, an Interpol officer said. Globally, illegal fishing cost at least an estimated $23 billion each year, with 1 in 4 fish thought to be caught illegally in Africa with its bountiful marine life. Alastair McDonald, a criminal intelligence officer at Interpol's fisheries unit, told Reuters that the fishing vessel Thunder was part of a fleet of 6 ships identified as some of the world's worst poachers. This is a great result for transnational organized crime-fighting cooperation because these guys have been doing this for 10 or 15 years, he said. We're cutting away at the model. We'll attack the insurance, the availability of supplies and crew, attack the landing ports and the markets they use. This is death by a thousand cuts, McDonald said. The illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing contributed to the depletion of fish stocks, reduced the profitability of legally caught seafood, and cut revenues for developing nations. The fishing vessel Thunder, a Nigerian-flagged vessel considered to be one of the world's worst illegal fishing ships, was pursued by Sea Shepherd Conservation Society environmental activists for 110 days from the Antarctic before it sank in April in the Gulf of Guinea. McDonald said the court in Sao Tome had convicted the captain, chief engineer, and second engineer of the Thunder and sentenced them to custodial sentences as well as fines. Documents seized from the Thunder were sent to Germany and sparked investigations across Europe, including companies in Spain where the ship's owners are believed to be based. The three crew faced charges of pollution, reckless driving, forgery, and negligence. Officials in Sao Tome could not be reached for comment. Touching on the scale of the poaching involving the fishing vessel Thunder and 5 other ships, the Interpol agent said the cargo of toothfish could typically be worth between $3 and $6 million, multiplied by 2 or 3 trips a year and by the 6 boats doing it. And they've been doing that for more than a decade. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars, he added. And in Indonesia, beloved elephant Yonki killed by ivory poachers, which sparks outrage. In this story from Agence France-Presse, as found on EcoWatch and carried on the Earth First Newswire. The brutal killing of a beloved elephant in Indonesia has sparked online anger, similar to the global outrage from the killing of Zimbabwe's Cecil the Lion. According to the Agence France-Presse, it's suspected that Yonki, a 35-year-old Sumatran elephant who helped patrol Indonesian jungles, died of poisoning at the hands of poachers. His maimed and bloodied body was found nearby a camp at the Bukit Barisan Selatan National Park where he lived. He was found around 7:30 p.m. with his 3-foot tusks hacked off, leaving just bloody stumps, and his legs still bearing the chains placed onto him by his keepers to ensure he stayed in the camp, the news agency reported. We are mourning the loss of an elephant who has been helping us in handling conflicts and helping forest rangers patrol the forest. He was a good elephant, Nazaruddin, the head of the Indonesian Mahout Forum, told AFP. Yonki's keepers are very shaken, Nazaruddin added. And pulling anchor on Cermak in Clackwat Sound, British Columbia, in this story from Intercontinental Cry. At the daybreak, Cermak has said it will begin pulling anchor on its new salmon farm north of Tofino, British Columbia. The province of British Columbia granted Cermak licenses and permits to operate a relocation fish farm at a site called Yaksuis in July. When Cermak attempted to anchor the farm there 10 days ago, 5 Aschutz men stepped onto the farm and told the Cermak crew to leave. They vowed they would risk arrest rather than see another salmon farm in their territory. The standoff began on September 9th as Cermak was dropping its anchors in a remote region in Aschutz territory. The Aschutz don't want more salmon farms because they have seen a decline in shellfish, salmon, and herring since salmon farms appeared in their territory in about 1999. There are currently already 16 Cermak salmon farm sites in Aschutz territory. Despite promises of employment and prosperity, only 15 jobs have been created at the remote village of 1,000 people. Aschutz Nation itself has 2,000 members in total. It's common sense, said Aschutz tourism business owner Lenny John, who was the first on the scene when Cermak tried to anchor the farm. We fish these waters for food. We don't go into Cermak's kitchen and leave a mess all over their floor. Food people and support poured into the remote protest camp. People slept in tents tied down to prevent them from blowing away. A small boat was used to cook meals. They called it the Yaksuis Ocean Action Camp. Yaksuis warriors stated that Cermak Salmon Farm was not legal because the Aschutz people had not been consulted. Nor did they consent. A requirement written into the protocol Cermak and MHSS signed. Consent is also a requirement to fulfill the legal obligations the province has in regard to Aschutz's collectively held Aboriginal rights and title. Additionally, free, prior, and informed consent is required under the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Therefore, they declared all Cermak protocols, agreements, and operations were nullified and illegal. We don't want any more salmon farm sites in our territory, and we'll be taking a much closer look at this industry, Joe James Rapanen says. We don't want future generations to inherit a legacy of pollution these waters feed us. Just because three chiefs signed your agreement doesn't mean you have the consent from the whole Aschutz Nation, Marshall Thomas told the Cermak crew. Lenny John said he would be watching where this farm goes. Cermak, he says, you are done here. Monday night, there was a community celebration dinner in Aschutz. The Aschutz are looking forward to written confirmation from Cermak and MHSS that no new fish farms will be sited, relocated, or expanded for time immemorial in their territory. This article originally appeared at Gorilla Radio Blog. And hidden underwater, Greenland's glaciers are melting fast in this story from the Environment News Service. West Greenland's fjords are much deeper than early models showed, and hidden there, warm ocean water is undercutting the island's glacial facies, raising sea levels faster than previously estimated glaciologists have found. A research team led by the University of California Irvine glaciologist Eric Rigneau battled rough waters and an onslaught of icebergs for 3 summers to map the remote channels for the first time. Their results have been accepted for publication in the journal Geophysical Research Letters and are now available online. Measurements are challenging to obtain beneath hundreds of meters of seawater in poorly charted ice-infested fjords, writes Rignall, who also works at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. He and co-authors Ian Fenty of JPL Silan Kai and Yung Zhu of UCI and Chris Kemp of TerraSond Limited obtained and analyzed around-the-clock measurements of the marine waters and their intersection with the coastal edge of Greenland's ice sheet. To document the critical intersection where the ocean hits the glacier, Renault used a $500,000 multi-beam sonar device that bounces sound off the seabed. The scientists discovered that some of Greenland's glaciers are perched on giant earthen sills, protecting them from the punishing seawater for now. But others are being eroded out of sight beneath the surface. They could collapse and melt much sooner than expected. Renault's team found that Greenland's glaciers flowing into the ocean are grounded deeper below sea level than previously measured. This means that the deeper, warmer ocean currents can erode glacial faces. In polar regions, the upper layers of ocean water are cold and fresh, Renault explains. Cold water is less effective at melting ice. The real ocean heat is at a depth of 350 to 400 meters and below. This warm, salty water is of subtropical origin and melts the ice much more rapidly, he said. Numerical ice sheet models do not take into account these interactions and, as a result, underestimate how fast the glaciers are responding to climate warming, Renault said. More than 90% of Earth's freshwater ice is held in the massive ice sheets and glaciers of the Antarctic and Greenland. As planetary temperatures climb, meltwaters from these vast stores of ice add to the rising sea levels. Greenland alone could raise sea levels by 7 meters, about 23 feet, if all of its ice melted. Next, Renault will be working on a new NASA-funded 5-year project called Ocean Melting Greenland. The team will head to the four corners of Greenland by ship and by plane. We hope that the data collected will be a game-changer for studying ice-ocean interaction in Greenland, said Renault. It will help modelers make better predictions of Greenland ice sheet melting in the future. To see a video, photos, or a narrative of the August 2014 expedition, go to news.uci.edu/Greenland. That's news.uci.edu/Greenland. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and at www.freakradio.org. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of this show, please tune in on Friday afternoons at 3 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can also hear a rebroadcast on Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, 90.3 KRFP. And that is broadcast at about 1:15 p.m. on Wednesdays, right after Democracy Now! And you can always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous versions of the Earth First Update. Free Radio Santa Cruz is currently looking for studios. If you know of a studio space in Santa Cruz that is affordable, you might earn a $500 reward. Send information to frsc@freakradio.org. Please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.